This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The European Union and Britain announced a fresh round of sanctions on Iran authorities in connection with the recent riots in the country. Palestinians demonstrate against an Israeli project to demolish a Palestinian Bedouin village in the occupied West Bank. The European Council calling on EU leaders to speed up talks on the use of confiscated Russian assets for the reconstruction of Ukraine. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafi. Good to have you with us. Top story this hour, the UK and the EU imposing new sanctions on the Islamic Republic of Iran over the country's response to the recent riots. The UK has added five more Iran officials to its sanctions list, while the EU has blacklisted 37 Iran officials and entities. London and Brussels say that their measures are a response to what they describe as Tehran's repression of its own people. Iran has repeatedly dismissed the allegation, saying it's the victim of a foreign-backed plot. The West has targeted various Iran individuals and entities with sanctions in recent months, citing similar pretexts. Last week, the EU Parliament also approved a non-binding resolution calling for the bloc to blacklist Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as a terrorist group. Tehran has repeatedly condemned the move as irresponsible and illogical. It's warned the EU about unpredictable consequences of any uncalculated move against the IRGC.
Europe certainly knows that Iran's hands are not tied in the face of uncalculated moves by European countries. Iran has the necessary power and will to take reciprocal actions. Iran responds to interaction with interaction and by confronting confrontation. The use of pressure and political tools to gain points is unacceptable to the Islamic Republic, which never deviates from its positions under such pressure.
Kanani added that any move against the IRGC would be tantamount to harming Iran's national security. He says that the IRGC is an organ of the Iranian government and the imposition of any sanction on it would be a clear violation of the UN Charter. He urged the EU not to shoot itself in the foot by damaging its relations with Iran. Meantime, the EU foreign policy chief has downplayed the prospect of blacklisting the IRGC, saying that a bloc cannot do this without an EU court ruling over the issue. Josep Borrell says that one cannot call an entity terrorist simply because he doesn't like that entity. Now, author and journalist Robert Fantina says that the European Union is using human rights as a political tool in order to pressure Iran.
The thing that was most striking about this whole situation with the EU increasing sanctions was talking about what they described as Iran's backsliding the human rights issue. Why do these countries then not sanction Israel, which has an atrocious human rights record? Why not Saudi Arabia? Why don't they sanction Saudi Arabia? Why are they picking Iran? It's simply because the government of Iran doesn't kowtow or toe the line of U.S. and Western demands. Because of that, these countries in the EU and the U.S. and so on they want to make Iran and the Iranians suffer. But this fantasy about punishing one country for human rights violations when it overlooks and even supports the human rights violations of other countries is complete hypocrisy.
Parliament speakers of Iran and Russia have stressed the importance of increased bilateral cooperation to counter U.S. sanctions imposed on both countries. In a joint presser, Iran Speaker Mohammad Ghalibaf said Tehran and Moscow are facing common threats posed by illegal U.S. sanctions. He said the two countries should expand banking cooperation and bilateral trade and use national currencies for transactions. Yaroslav Volodin, Speaker of Russian State Duma, said that U.S. sanctions have pushed the two countries to boost bilateral cooperation. Earlier, Volodymyr Galibov co-chaired a meeting of Iran-Russia Joint Economic Commission. Iran and Parliament Speaker said in that meeting that Iran and Russia must carefully consider the strategic 25-year cooperation agreement between them and start implementing it as soon as possible. Thousands of Yemenis have hit the streets of the northwestern city of Sada to denounce the burning of a copy of the Holy Quran by a right-wing Swedish-Danish politician in Stockholm. Demonstrators chanted slogans against the sacrilegious act, warning that the Swedish government would be responsible for the consequences. Protesters urged the leaders of the Western countries to stop their anti-Islam activities under the influence of the Israeli regime. They also urged Muslim nations to unite against the use of anti-Islam rhetoric. Condemnations have been pouring in from across the Muslim world following the desecration of the Quran in the Swedish capital on Saturday. Now, many countries, including Iran, Pakistan, the UAE, Jordan, and Kuwait, have already denounced the move in the strongest possible terms. Palestinians have staged a rally in the occupied West Bank against an Israeli plan to demolish the Bedouin village of Khan al-Ahmar. Demonstrators held flags and chanted slogans against Israeli settlement activities on the occupied territories. Palestinians say their regime is stealing their ancestral land with its demolition drive under different pretexts. Tel Aviv has recently intensified settlement activities as part of its expansionist agenda. All Israeli settlements on the occupied Palestinian lands are illegal under international law and the Geneva Conventions. The UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned the regime's settlement activities. Now, as Europe remains divided over whether or not to provide main battle tanks to Kiev, the Kremlin says that there is an increasing nervousness within the NATO-military alliance.
There is increasing nervousness among the members of the alliance, but of course all countries that are involved directly or indirectly in pumping weapons into Ukraine and raising its technological capabilities bear responsibility for continuing the conflict.
Now, Peskov added that the Ukrainian people will pay the price for the West's pseudo support for Kiev. He also described the U.S. move to impose sanctions on a Russian private military contractor, Wagner Group, as insignificant, saying that they would have no practical effect. Ukraine has been calling on its Western allies to provide it with heavy military equipment, including tanks, to be used in its war with Russia. Since the beginning of the war almost a year ago, the U.S. and Europe have provided Kiev with billions of dollars worth of arms and military hardware. Moscow has frequently warned that Western weapons to Kiev will only escalate the war and increase the suffering of the Ukrainian people. The European Council has called on EU leaders to speed up talks on the use of confiscated Russian assets for the reconstruction of Ukraine. President Charles Michel says the profits from the frozen assets could be used for reconstruction efforts. Michel described the proposal as a question of justice. The EU has blocked 300 billion euros of assets belonging to the Russian Central Bank in November. The move is part of sanctions the bloc has imposed on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Moscow has hit back with its own measures, including limitations to the supply of energy to Europe. The EU is planning to deport a record number of asylum seekers this year deemed to be as illegal immigrants, while applying new limits on the number of Ukrainian refugees who wish to enter the 27-member bloc. Rights group insists that the EU has a legal responsibility to treat all refugees equally regardless of their ethnicity. From Brussels, Jerome Hughes has more.
Already in 2023, 30 refugees have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea as they attempted to reach the EU, according to figures from the United Nations. The EU's border and coast guard agency, Frontex, has in the past been lambasted for pushing back unsafe boats, resulting in deaths. On Thursday, the new head of the agency vowed to end this practice.
I am responsible for the fact that my people don't participate in anything called a pushback. So I think that is absolutely clear. That is the legal framework I work in. So that's it.
According to OLAF, the EU's anti-fraud office, at least 2,000 refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea during 2020 and 2021 as they were pushed back from the EU coastline by Frontex. the agency prevented at least 40,000 asylum seekers from reaching the EU, which blatantly breaks international law. In just 10 months, the EU has welcomed more than 4 million Ukrainian refugees. They are afforded all the same rights as EU citizens. However, if you're from a different part of the world, torn up by Western powers, it's a different story. We visited a shelter for Afghans in Brussels.
Before we come in the Europe, we think the Europe care about women, care about children. Now we come in here, not. They don't care about women, they don't care about children.
When the children go to school, they need food, they need clothes. And for everything, we need to work. So we need the job permit.
There are no such problems for Ukrainians. Of course, that's to be welcomed, but rights groups are asking why the discrimination. EU Home Affairs ministers will meet in Stockholm, Sweden next Thursday to agree on a more effective strategy to deport asylum seekers who don't meet refugee status criteria. Campaigners point out there are no plans to adopt a similar policy for refugees arriving here from Western Ukraine, arguably a relatively safe region. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
US President Joe Biden has been in office for 2 years now, and his approval rating has never been lower. The first part of his term has been defined by constant crises, and that's why many are speculating that he will not be able to run for a re-election. Rami Mazahari reports from Chicago.
United States President Joe Biden has just reached the halfway mark of his term, and perhaps the best word to sum up the past 2 years is a new phrase, polycrisis, which is defined as the simultaneous creation of several catastrophic events. Most of them started with foreign policy. Biden totally backtracked on his promise to re-enter the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy agreement, and then charged into exacerbating the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sanctions on Russia have backfired so badly that the average family has lost over a month's salary since Biden took office, or $7,400. Biden came to power with total control of Congress, thanks to big campaign promises of rebuilding after the devastation of the coronavirus lockdowns.
The Build Back Better plan that was supposed to give you all these, you know, workers' rights, it was supposed to, like, you know, put so much money into infrastructure, it was supposed to improve the education system. Barely any part of the Build Back Better plan made it past legislation.
Biden's approval rating is currently the lowest of his presidency at just 40%. The Democrats lost control of the lower House of Representatives in the midterm elections due to widespread disillusionment. The country now faces 2 years of congressional dysfunction, and many wonder if the progressive spirit of 2020 can be recaptured.
Every time Republicans have control, they will use whatever power they can, little or a lot, to get what they want passed. Whenever Democrats are in charge, whatever the Republicans left them, they'll cling on to it no matter how far, you know, right it advanced. And so the strategy here is, it's bipartisan if you look at the big picture. The Republicans move things right, they take away all these social and civil liberties, and the Democrats, when elected, preserve just exactly where they are so that when the Republicans win again, they can move them further right.
Record inflation, another recession, a divided Congress, and no end to forever war. The Biden era can't be defined by just one crisis. A recent poll found that 60% of Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election in 2024. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Okay, from America to the Americas, Brazil and Argentina planning for greater economic integration, including a common currency, which would wean off reliance on the U.S. dollar in bilateral trade. President Lula da Silva and his Argentine counterpart, Alberto Fernandez, made the revelation in a joint article. The text says the Brazilian Buenos Aires want to eliminate barriers through their exchanges and encourage the use of local currencies. The two countries have also decided to speed up discussions on a common South American currency aimed at boosting regional trade. Lula had brought up the idea of a common currency during his presidential campaign. He has chosen Argentina for his first trip abroad since taking office. Relations between Brazil and Buenos Aires were tense during the term of the former right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro. Meantime, the Brazilian president has accused his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro, of committing genocide against the indigenous people of the Amazon region amid public outrage over humanitarian catastrophe there. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says that Bolsonaro's far-right administration is responsible for that crisis. Lula says that a previous administration encouraged the 20,000 illegal miners who flooded the region during his term and caused death and destruction. The president says that Bolsonaro just abandoned the Yanomami people. Lula made a comment after a visit to the Amazon. Children in that region are reportedly dying of malnutrition and diseases caused by poisoning due to gold mining. Bolsonaro denies responsibility, despite criticism of his environmental policies that led to a 60% rise in Amazon's deforestation. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail, the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss.
Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, As'aluka bihaqqika wa qudsika wa azami sifatika wa asma'ik. أن تجعل أوقاتي من الليل والنهار بذكرك معمورا وبخدمتك موصولا وأعمالي عندك مقبولا حتى تكون أعمالي وأورادي كلها وردا واحدا وحالي في خدمتك
Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we were discussing this excerpt of the Divine Kumail supplication. Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab. My Lord, My Lord, My Lord. As'aluka bihaqqika wa qudsika wa a'zami sifatika wa asma'ik. I ask you by your truth, your holiness, and the greatness of your attributes and names. أن تجعل أوقاتي من الليل والنهار بذكرك معمورة. That you make my times in night and day inhabited by your remembrance. وبخدمتك موصولة. And joined to your service. وأعمالي عندك مقبولة. And make my acts acceptable to you. حتى تكون أعمالي وأورادي كلها وردا واحدة وحالي في خدمتك سرمدا. So that my acts and my prayers may all be a single litany and my occupation with your service everlasting. يا سيدي يا من عليه معولي يا من إليه شكوت أحوالي. O my master, O he upon whom I depend, O he to whom I complain of my states. In this regard, we were discussing the concept of sincerity as one of the conditions of acceptance of our deeds. If we want to pray to the Almighty Allah, to make our deeds acceptable to Him, وَأَعْمَالِي عِنْدَكَ مَقْبُولَةٌ O Allah, make my acts acceptable to You, we need to be aware of the conditions, prerequisites of acceptance of our deeds. One of the most important things in this is the concept of sincerity. And the concept of sincerity further subcategorizes into sincerity for anything related to the Almighty Allah, specifically sincerity in love of Allah. The Holy Quran says that this is an important thing because it is the requisite of faith. وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَشَدُّ حُبًّا لِلَّهِ The faithful have a more ardent love for Allah. Now, the reference to the heart in this narration of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, where he says, "Qalb haramullah," the heart is the sanctuary of Allah, is precise. It is really significant because a sanctuary is something which is guarded by other things. It is a guarded area. It is closed upon every stranger. Its inhabitants are not harmed, nor do they experience any fear. It is a sanctuary. It is haram. No stranger is allowed to enter. So, heart is the secured sanctuary of Allah. No one is allowed to enter without the permission of the Almighty Allah, or the one who is a truthfully servant of the Almighty Allah. No harm or evil can touch it while it is in the heart.
Beseech you by your glory and honor, by your supremely high attributes, and by your names, to cause me to utilize my time day and night in your remembrance by engaging myself in serving you, and to let my deeds be acceptable to you, so much so that all my actions and offerings may be transformed into one continuous and sustained effort, and my life may take the form of constant and perpetual service to you, O my Master, O you upon whom I rely, O you unto whom I express my distress.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever, the feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua. Dear listeners, we said that when Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, the heart is the sanctuary and haram of the Almighty Allah, this reference to the heart in this narration as sanctuary is very precise. It is of utmost significance. It is due to this very reason that the truthful ones of the servants of the Almighty Allah wholly dedicate their love to Allah, such that they never associate His love with any other love, whatever it may be, unless if it is in extension to the love of Allah, unless it does not negate the love of Allah. They take one more step. They do not love anything other than the Almighty Allah. In the a prayer that we will mention, we can sense the ardor of love and truthfulness, insincerity in the love of Allah. This is the words of Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. O my master, towards you is my desire, to you is my fear, and towards you is my aspiration. My hope has driven me to you, and unto you, O the one, I have placed my determination, and on what you possess, I have unfolded my wish. Imam Zainul Abidin, out of this sincerity, the trueness of sincerity continues, for you are my greatest hope and fear. With you, my love has become accustomed, and to you, I have surrendered myself. Imam continues, O my Lord, my heart is living with your remembrance. This is the living thing. This is the most important organ of the truthful servants of the Almighty Allah. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Economic divide.
He was just a school teacher, but he was elected by Peruvians in a closely contested election. But then he got overthrown in a coup, and his former VP took over. So what happened? Why are there reports of U.S. complicity? Mineral-rich Peru, like copper and gold, the subject of this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, we're going to take a look at Pedro Castillo's presidency. First, he came to power to restore Peru's economy. That's what he got elected for, to favor the poor and the working class. But then what happened? Oligarchs and rich were angered, including congressmen. We're going to take a look at why that made them angry. Next, taking a look at the coup itself, there was a quick VP succession to presidents. How did that happen? Some are speculating and deducting there was U.S. interference. The U.S. ambassador was a former CIA agent. Just take a look at that fact. We're going to break that open for you. Next up, overall, Latin American pink tide has taken place. You have leftist governments that have come into power, and they are anti-U.S. and anti-Western financial system. And the U.S., of course, is angered by the rise of the leftist presidents.
Peru has been going through a tough time. In December 2021, President Pedro Castillo was elected as the country's president. Castillo is a 53-year-old former schoolteacher from a humble rural background and was elected on a wave of frustration with conventional politics. Castillo replaced more than half of the ministries with new people in a bid to reshuffle the country's economic and political structure. But that apparently turned the ruling establishment against him. In an apparent bid to reform the country, he announced that he was dissolving the opposition-dominated Congress, installing a curfew, and would rule by decree. But Castillo was impeached for his moral incapacity to exercise power after a litany of crises, including 6 investigations against him, 5 cabinet reshuffles, and large protests. Castillo became the 3rd president since 2018 to be sacked under the moral incapacity provision in the Constitution. He was replaced by Dina Boluarte. Her presidency comes during a period of political turmoil in Peru that began in 2017, as she is the 6th president in 5 years. It was reported that the U.S. may have had a hand in the coup. The U.S. ambassador in Peru, a veteran CIA agent named Lisa Kenna, met with the country's defense minister just one day before the coup.
Time now to take a look at social media posts. The new year 2023 started out with protests because people are still angry about the fact that their democratically elected president, Pedro Castillo, was ousted. So we took a look and tried to pick the social media posts that reflected that and, of course, a worldview on this as reactions were posted on social media posts. Our first post said another undemocratic Latin American coup supported by the European Union. All for what? Just to facilitate Western business interests at great expense to the people of Peru. Next, don't sell EU support for Latin American coups short. EU support also clearly demonstrates subservience and fealty to the U.S. Next up, Lima's Plaza Manco Capac, where hundreds of people have camped out in protest against a parliamentary dictatorship, coup, and repression in Peru, which is filled with art and music. Next, Peru's U.S.-backed coup regime appears to be setting the stage to hand unelected presidential power to right-wing congressman Jose Williams, the former top military commander. He has been linked to drug cartels and covered up a military massacre of civilians. Gosh, I was surprised by some of these picks that our research department picked, but that does show in terms of the interference by the U.S. in one sense, and of course the way that the oligarchs and the elites were angered by Pedro Castillo's election. Let's find out what our guests think. That's more important to get an analysis on that. First up, we have Rafael Padula. He's a graduate professor in international political economy of the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, Institute of Economics, who joins us. All right, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at what has occurred when we take a look at Pedro Castillo, Rafael Padula, he was a school teacher from what we understand, and he was promised to restructure Peru's economy, to favor the poor and the working class. That's why he got elected. But it seems like the oligarchs, even congressmen, the rich congressmen, I must say, they were angry about this election, especially, Castillo replaced more than half of the ministries with new people, which is why they turned against him. Is that how this happened? Is that the case?
I think that Peruvian oligarchs, Peruvian elites, they like to control the government, they like to control the president. So we can remember about Rolando Humala, a radical left president. They couldn't change the neoliberal policies because he was really, really controlled by these elites. And it was really surprising that Rolando Humala could end his mandate. So with Castillo, it's the same thing. Castillo has a lot of proposes that he was against these elites' interests, like ending neoliberal policies, like nationalize natural resources, including the Camisea gas fields. So Pedro Castillo was really, really contrary to these elites' interests. So they couldn't control Pedro Castillo. So for these oligarchs, for these Peruvian elites, it was better to take him off the power, to end his presidency with a coup.
All right. Thank you for that. Let's find out what Bruno Beclini thinks. He joins us. Bruno Beclini is an academic and political commentator. Bruno Beclini, welcome to Economic Divide. What happened to Peru? It was a political upheaval, and really it happened so quickly. when you think about it in terms of the coup. I mean, at this point, it was so quick that the people have wondered why this happened at warp speed. And one of the things that has been assessed is that the U.S. may have had a hand in the coup, mainly because the U.S. ambassador in Peru is a veteran CIA agent by the name of Lisa Kenna. For example, she met the country's defense minister just one day before the coup happened. Do you think that the U.S. has a hand in this coup, which obviously it has a long history of having hands in color revolutions and coups in general, especially in Latin America?
We must understand that the bread and butter of U.S. is to have links, ties from their diplomatic, personal, their diplomacy and intelligence network to the top-level hierarchy of Latin American states. So it is almost impossible and unbelievable to affirm that any coup d'etat in Latin America is not at least, well, very well informed and try to have links to the U.S. personnel operating in the country. This ambassador in Peru is not the only one who is operating there. I insist, Keiko Fujimori's husband is a gringo, is a U.S. citizen who has lots of accusations of money laundering. So we can't understand any coup d'etat in Latin America without looking with very, I would say, very objective point of view to the U.S. movements inside each one of our countries.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program. First up, we're going to take a look at oil supplies in the world and how that stands. Obviously, it's something that's important in terms of the markets. Well, Western sanctions are actually reshaping the global energy markets. Russian oil is being rerouted to places like Asia, Africa, and Latin America, while countries in West Asia, or suppliers in West Asia, are boosting sales, meanwhile, to the EU. So you can see the shift there. Now, Middle Eastern energy exporters, or exporters in West Asia, have shifted from the traditional markets in Asia and are, at this point, based on what they are saying, they're reaping the benefits from the skyrocketing fossil fuel prices in Europe. So Europe is paying the price for this. Now, talk about Europe. Let's take a look at the Eurozone and where it stands when it comes to its economies. Well, the Eurozone economy is forecast to shrink. The region is headed for a severe recession. That's what's forecasted. There are indications that prices will rise by over 6%, which they have already. We're in almost approaching the end of January. And the unemployment rate will increase from the current 7.1%, which it's standing now. It will increase to 7.1% as the new year progresses. Now, this is a particular topic that we have a lot of focus on and interest on, I should say. And this regards poverty, and it's on East Africa. Now, Oxfam came out with this, which is combined with famine there, and it calls it the cause of neglect. It says that 500,000 people across East Africa are on the brink of famine. Of course, famine and poverty actually do go hand in hand. The number of people facing extreme hunger in Ethiopia, in Kenya, and in Somalia has more than doubled since the year before, from over 10 million to now 23 million as of today. Now, nearly 500,000 are already facing starvation based on what we have found out. As a matter of fact, this is so important to us that we're going to take a look at the next half of this report, which focuses on East Africa, and this one, again, on famine. One person on average is dying every 48 seconds from acute hunger in East Africa. 5.7 million children are acutely malnourished, and this was for the year 2022. 350,000 Somali children, for example, will die by the summer of this year if action is not taken immediately. Okay, I have to take just a second to catch my breath because those are really shocking numbers, and that needs to be dealt with. Now, this next piece of news is somewhat of a promising piece for Afghan and the Afghan government headed by the Taliban. The Taliban has actually signed an oil deal with Chinese firm. It is the first major international energy contract for the country. That's a positive sign, don't you think? It's a 25-year oil extraction agreement. Note, extraction. Got to underline that word. China's company, CAPEIC, KEPIC, will be drilling for oil. So they're going to be drilling for the oil. Shows how much natural resources Afghanistan does have. And the Chinese investment for doing that is up to $150 million a year. It's not bad. That's going to increase now in increments to $540 million in 3 years' time. And in terms of jobs, 3,000 jobs will be given to Afghans. So that's a positive piece of news for that country. Really, it needs more news like that.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section of the program. In this segment, we're going to focus on structural discrimination in Peru and how it relates to the indigenous population and its relation to Peru's natural resources. That's our focus, the natural resources, which are located mainly in the south. First up, for decades, the rich and the elites in Peru, they have tried to marginalize the indigenous population from their rights to mines, again, concentrated in the south of the country. The indigenous peoples of Peru comprise about 24% of the population. We're looking at around 5,500,000 Peruvians. That's quite a bit, don't you think? Next up, Castillo. When he came to power, he fought hard to get the rights of the indigenous population when it came to their share of mining projects. Now, Peru's mining industry is essential to the country's economic development. It accounts for nearly 10% of the country's GDP. That's a lot. Mineral export revenues, they reached $27.2 billion for the year 2021, and that represented 60% of the country's total exports. Now, keep in mind this fact. Peru is the world's second largest producer of copper. Silver and zinc are also at the top of the list, but most importantly, it's Latin America's largest producer of gold. That's right. You didn't know that about Peru, did you? Next, we'll take a look at Peru's operating mines. There are 200 of them, and several large projects are ready for development. Now, back in March of 2022, direct employment in the mining sector in that country came to a little over 273,000 workers, exceeding 2021 by 4.5%. Now, Peru, in terms of the projects that it has, the main ones, there are 43 of them, and they're in different stages of development, targeting a variety of metals and minerals, representing a total investment of more than $53 billion, as you're about to see. Okay, so that's the figure that we're looking at. Copper projects, they represent 69%, about $36.5 billion. Gold, 15%. And then iron ore, which comes in at 11%. So that gives you an idea about the percentage and share of the exports that we're looking at of the extraction that's happening. Next, UK, in terms of now the foreign mining investment, the UK is Peru's largest foreign investor. It is followed by China, Canada, then the United States, and then Mexico. Now, 11 countries have project portfolio investments in the mining sector. Up next, we will look at Castillo and what he actually realized was important to reform. He proposed what was called a new approach for mining companies to end the social gaps and to avoid conflicts in this sector. And that's pretty important because that kept the country from progressing in that sector, as was mentioned by Castillo. Now, Castillo's government has said, in terms of his direct quote, although the responsibility for closing gaps falls on the state, it is necessary to involve and to commit mining companies to greater social investment. That's something that was missing from mainly the indigenous population. Now, this may have angered the mining companies and the oligarchs who had control over the lucrative contracts. Okay, so there you have it. That's our quick look somewhat at the mining sector vis-a-vis the indigenous. Let's find out what our guests think. Rafael Padula, who's a graduate professor in international political economy of the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, rejoins us. Rafael, welcome back. We want to take a look in this question at the way that you have a new group of left-wing presidents, as you're well aware, to have taken over in Latin America, not so much leaning towards the West economic and financial models. And one particular good example would be Brazil's president, Lula da Silva, who even has said he wants to move away from the dollar. How much do you think that Castillo fits into that mold of moving away from the Western financial system, bothering countries like the U.S.?
Oh, President Lula have been talking about to strengthen the regional integration in South America, the BRICS, and the relations with countries from the South, from the Global South. And in this way, in this sense, he has been talking about to run out of dollar as much as possible, making commerce and finance relations out of dollar with some kind of arrangement with local money, with local national money, or some kind of swaps out of dollar, because it's really, really, really visible now how much U.S. Enjoy not only the power of the dollar, the power of have the international money, but also that USA uses sanctions to punish governments which are not aligned with USA, excluding them from the international financial system, like USA did with Venezuela, with Iran, and now with Russia.
All right, very well. Let's find out what Bruno Biclini thinks. He is an academic and political commentator who rejoins us. Bruno Biclini, welcome back. I want to ask the same question that I asked Rafael Padula about the fact that you have these left-wing presidents that have come into power. Obviously, Castillo fits into that mold, and they basically have taken over Latin America because they just weren't reaping the benefits of the Western financial system. So they're trying to lean away from that. Perfect example, obviously, would be Lula da Silva. In the case of him, he has said that he wants to move away from the dollar. And this is something that is not favoring or going too well when it comes to countries like the U.S. Do you think this is bothering the U.S.?
Yeah, for sure. And there is a campaign, a dirty campaign, inside the hegemonic media corporations of all Latin America, insisting that Brazil must leave the BRICS, must leave the BRICS bloc, which is something unbelievable, which is an absurd, because all of the world understands that the U.S. dollar as the world currency, it's a form of being blackmailed by the U.S. and having being target of being sanctioned by them, just like what they did with Iran and what they are doing with Russia. It's a kind of financial dictatorship when the U.S. says that someone must be inside the SWIFT or outside the SWIFT. We must be as away as possible from the U.S. dollar as an international currency, develops and increase the sound of Banco del Sur, and be an important part of the new developed bank, which is the Bank of the BRICS. Outside of this is the projection of the World Bank and the International and the IMF, saying that the world will not grow more than 3% of this next year, and we'll have a recession. If we towards our economy to the Asian network and the Asian development, we can move as far as possible from the U.S. currency and far as possible from the blackmail coming from the financial dictatorship ruled by Washington and London.
Power struggle in the country has continued as thousands of small farms struggle to survive the worst drought in half a century. Without rain, farmers cannot plant potatoes, and the dying grass can no longer sustain herds of sheep. Many Castillo supporters are poor indigenous Peruvians. They say that President Boluarte must resign, snap elections need to be held, and that the former president needs to be released. world's number two copper producer, global economic pressures like inflation prompted by the pandemic.
Los cerros del campo es todo seco. Tenemos manantiales. Esos manantiales también se están secando. Necesitamos.
Hace que las alpacas aborten, causa mortalidad de animales adultos, causa baja fertilidad. Es decir, es el problema más grave de la ganadería alpaquera.
Have also hit Latin America hard. Peru's oil production has also declined sharply since the 1990s. This is despite Peru's considerable petroleum potential. The country is said to have 422 million barrels of proven and probable reserves, along with 14 billion barrels of oil resources. During November 2022, Peru pumped an average of 37,875 barrels per day, which was flat compared to a year earlier. Furthermore, the outlook for Peru's embattled hydrocarbon sector is bleak, despite the Andean country's considerable petroleum potential. There's also a long history of industry operations in the Amazon, causing environmental degradation, further accelerating the deterioration of the country's social problems. The latest developments in Peru's long-running political crisis will roil the country's post-pandemic economic recovery, which has been struggling to maintain momentum since 2021.
When it comes to the coup in Peru, one thing has become very clear, and that is the role of the U.S. intervention, which may have played a hand in Pedro Castillo's overthrow. First, the scenario that unfolded. The U.S. ambassador in Peru, a veteran CIA agent named Lisa Kinna, met with the country's defense minister just one day before the democratically elected president, Pedro Castillo, was ousted in a coup. Lisa Kinna's bio reads, from the U.S. regime change playbook. As an accessory to the coup, she worked for the CIA for 9 years, as well as the Pentagon. After Lisa Kinna met with Peru's defense minister, he ordered the military to turn against Castillo. Also noteworthy was that Lisa Kinna met with Dina Boluarte and reiterated Washington's wholehearted support for her. The coup set off mass protests all across Peru. The unelected government unleashed brutal violence and police killed numerous demonstrators. The coup in Peru has also set off anger from other South American countries, channeled against the U.S., which they slammed for interference in another country's affairs. These Latin America countries have criticized or even refused to recognize Peru's coup, which included Mexico, Argentina, Bolivia, Colombia, Honduras, Venezuela, Cuba, and various Caribbean nations. The CIA has organized many coups against democratically elected left-wing leaders in Latin America, from Guatemala's president Jacobo Arbenz in 1954 to Chile's president Salvador Allende in 1973 to numerous attempts for a regime change against the late Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez. That does it for this section.
And in conclusion, what has happened to Peru? It's a classic case where the status quo set by the rich and also by the oligarchs was threatened by a new entry in the form of Pedro Castillo, a school teacher of which he wanted to fight for the poor and make sure that they got their end of what society had to offer. However, that obviously made the oligarchs and the rich very angry. Now, you add to that U.S. interference, which is something that is now well known. Well, there you have it. You have a coup that's happened that goes against the people that the Peruvians elected. For what other reasons could there be for an overthrow of Castillo? But this story is not over, as the recent protests demonstrate that ordinary Peruvians will not give up on Castillo. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thank you so much for tuning in. From Mika Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.